Offline is brought to you by NetSuite. What does the future hold for business? Ask 9 experts and you'll get 10 answers. Rates will rise or fall. Inflation's up or down. Can someone please invent a crystal ball?
Huh.
Until then, over 38,000 businesses have future-proofed their business with NetSuite by Oracle, the number one cloud ERP, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one fluid platform. With one unified business management suite, there's one source of truth, giving you the visibility and control you need to make quick decisions. With real-time insights and forecasting, you're peering into the future with actionable data. When you're closing the books in days, not weeks, you're spending less time looking backwards and more time on what's next. Whether your company is earning millions or even hundreds of millions, NetSuite helps you respond to immediate challenges and seize your biggest opportunities. Speaking of opportunity, download the CFO's Guide to AI and Machine Learning at netsuite.com/offline. The guide is free to you at netsuite.com/offline, netsuite.com/offline.
Hey everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? New Yorker staff writer Jonathan Blitzer on immigration in Trump 2.0.
The people don't realize kind of how epic the international stakes of U.S. immigration policy are. Understandably, because they're bombarded with all of this news, and immigration policy itself is incredibly complex and it's multifaceted. You don't experience it as acutely with refugee policy, because in that case, the U.S. government is already controlling who gets vetted, how they get vetted, and when and how they arrive in the United States. Whereas with asylum law, you're dealing with people who very much show up at America's door needing protection. The government by law is required to extend that protection to them, but administratively, politically, it's much more challenging.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow. In the absence of attention, and when we're conditioned to respond to attention qua attention, you get a lot of pathological seeking of negative attention.
Yeah.
Just this kind of troll addiction. And that's not, you know, that may sound like,
leads you right to the White House.
Well, that was the point I was going to make. It's like, you may be like, well, that's kind of a, that's true. But like, we have watched this break the brains of some of the most powerful people in the world and produced a model of public discourse that is now 100% the dominant model of both the most powerful man in the world who runs the most powerful military named Donald Trump and the richest man in the world,
yeah,
who also seems to be maybe running the country. And both of them have this as a core part of their personalities now.
I'm Jon Favreau.
I'm Max Fisher.
And you just heard from today's guest, MSNBC host and author of the exceptional new book, The Sirens Call, Chris Hayes. So I actually talked to Chris on this show a few years ago about a New Yorker piece he wrote that ultimately became this book.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which might be...
So you're a co-author.
So I'm a co-author, basically. It might be the most offline book I've ever read.
Yeah,
and I know that there have been books we've talked about where you said, like, this is like an offline Bible.
Right.
This is it. This is the, this ties it all together.
It's not just about technology. It's about society. It's about politics. It's how the root of all of that is so much of our digital distraction.
Yes, and it's framed around attention as the world's most valuable and finite resource of this age.
Yeah, absolutely.
And specifically how the competition for our attention has made us as miserable as we are.
A war for our attention, I would argue.
A war.
Yeah.
It is a war. Anyway, highly encourage anyone listening to read it.
Absolutely.
Especially if you've enjoyed the conversations that Max and I have had here. Mm-hmm. Chris and I talked about so many things in the book, including how our attention economy benefits authoritarians.
Mm-hmm.
This is my big fear that I have articulated.
Absolutely. I fully agree.
How Democrats need to change and operate in this environment. Whether Barack Obama could have won an election in this attention environment.
Right.
It was a great conversation, and we will get to that in a minute. But first, there was obviously a lot of news this week, and you can catch up on all the latest Elon over at Pod Save America.
Yeah.
But in the spirit of reclaiming our attention, we're announcing a fun, exciting project this week. A lot of you have asked about the offline challenge. How are we doing with the phone addictions?
Not so good. Not so great, yeah.
Am I hopeless? Maybe. Would we ever do another challenge? The answer is yes.
Yes.
Starting this week, the offline challenge returns. And this time, we're going a bit bigger.
Mm-hmm.
All kidding aside, since last time we've done this challenge, we have seen some real improvement, you and I.
Yeah.
Though I've definitely backslid quite a bit.
Especially in the last week or two, it's been really tough.
Yes. But I think that we have both learned it's impossible to do our jobs.
Yeah.
And even if you don't have jobs like we do, pay attention to the news
Yeah.
Without ever being on your phone. So this time, instead of only trying to cut down our phone time, we are going to focus our energy specifically on our focus.
Focus, yeah.
For the next few weeks, we're going to be taking on a series of challenges aimed at helping us improve our focus, which is our ability to focus on an individual task like writing or reading a book or being present with loved ones, finding the willpower to put down the phone after an hour of doom scrolling, or just generally feeling in control of our minds and what we pay attention to. We're going to get into what those challenges will look like in a moment. But first, how are you feeling about this? You had a good thought on why this is actually the perfect challenge to do in this political moment.
So, I mean, at the most basic level, we've talked a lot about how everybody's first task for the next 4 years is to get yourself and the people around you through it, that you can't do anything else unless you can do that. But more broadly, I genuinely come to believe, thanks to Chris's book, thanks to a lot of the discussions that we've had, that lost focus is really at the foundation of so many of the big societal and political problems that we have talked about. And we've also talked about how building a progressive movement has to start with being able to speak to people's needs at a time when people feel alienated, they feel dispossessed, they're isolated, they, you know, everybody's doom scrolling, everybody's surrounded by misinformation and conspiracies in ways that have led a lot of people to embrace the easy answers from the kind of MAGA cultural right of grievance, nihilism, selfishness, hypermasculinity. So when we talk about lost focus being at the center of that, like focus meaning literally just your ability to control your attention in any given moment, and those moments add up to hours, add up to days, add up to a lifetime. Like when you spend hours doom scrolling on your phone, even, I don't mean specifically you, I mean anyone you,
but
although
you could
obviously
mean that.
It could also mean me. Even though you know you will regret that time, even though you know you will look back and think, I would have been better off if I read a news story, that's lost focus. When you wake up in the middle of the night and your brain starts pinwheeling because your anxiety is spiraling about what's in the news, that's lost focus. When you feel drained at the end of the day because you spent your commute or whatever ruminating about the news, this is something I do a lot, that's lost focus.
Or you can listen to podcasts and during your commute where other people ruminate
about the news. That's right, ruminate for you, yeah. Which is why...
Which I also do, even though I'm one of the ruminators.
I know.
Surreal
I
fucking...
Know. Well, this, I mean, this is this
human
week's
centipede
episode.
Of ruminating.
That's a beautiful image, John. Thank you. And congratulations to everyone on their commute who's imagining that now. But it is like, it, you know, this week's episode is, it's a testament to the news has gotten so bad that the show that usually covers tech news now has to be a reprieve from it. But like,
there's also one more thing that I noticed is, but it's like a daily thing.
Mm-hmm.
I am trying to do a work thing.
Yes.
And so I'm in the Slack channel, or I need to go to the Slack channel because someone put something in there. There's a there's a clip for me to approve for Pod Save America that someone cut, right? A sound.
Yeah.
And I'll go in there. But then I see, oh, all the other channels, there's notifications, and I got to check out that notification. Suddenly I'm like, what did I come into the Slack for? Oh, I have to approve the clip.
All the time.
And
yeah.
Then I was also writing something for the show, but now I completely forgot what that is. This is like my whole daily existence.
Yes. And this is, it's not even just when you're on your devices. Our synapses are just completely burned by being overloaded with dopamine. People can't read anymore.
Yep.
I mean, it's like literally becoming harder to read because we don't have the willpower to focus on it anymore. And then it's so easy to extrapolate out from that when you talk about people getting more addicted to their phones because of lost focus. We've talked many times about how that leads people to more misinformation and conspiracies because it kind of preys on having a more impulsive attention span. It's driving the rise in social isolation, which then in turn leads to this culture of hypermasculinity, anxiety and depression among young people. So these are all of these like huge problems that are really leading a lot of people, I think, to the MAGA right and making it hard to build a progressive movement that are much bigger than lost focus, but resolving our ability to control our own focus, I think, has to be the first step to fixing that, because we can't fix any of those other things unless we can take back our own brains, really, from these tech companies that are using this incredibly sophisticated technology to take it away from us so they can sell fucking ads against it.
Yes. And even if you removed the social media component from it, which is probably the biggest part.
Right. Totally.
You know, whether it's podcasts, mm-hmm. whether it's television, right. whether it's just like we are.
Yeah.
It is so now deeply ingrained, which is why Chris calls it like the age of attention.
Yes.
It's bigger than even the attention economy, though that's right. That's the driver of it.
Right, right, right.
But
right.
it's so ingrained in us now that even mm-hmm. without social media,
right.
there is a focus issue for all of us.
I find if I'm trying to get much better about taking time to socialize with people and have deep connections. Like after talking to Derek the other week, I've really been thinking about how important that is. It's hard to focus in that. Yep. It's harder to focus. I feel myself, you know, thinking, oh, what's going on my phone? Or like, we've been talking for 45 minutes. It's hard to stay focused that long.
Yeah.
That is not a natural state of affairs. That's not how our brains are supposed to work. And that's why we have designed a set of challenges that we're going to go through in the next few weeks to try to relearn how to be present, how to decide what we want to do with our brains and our attention in any given moment. And then I think that is hopefully going to manifest in all sorts of ways.
So right before we started recording, our producer, Emma, who also had this idea of focus, which was fantastic, mm-hmm. Made us sit in front of a painting, or at least a screen of a painting.
Yeah.
We do have budgetary constraints. is a way to measure our focus. Mm-hmm. Why did we do that, and why did I do better than you?
Why you did better than me is a... I was surprised by that one. I gotta give you... What if it turned out that actually all along you've had incredible focus, and you're just choosing to put it all on bad tweets?
At minute... I don't know, it felt like minute 100, but it was probably minute 2 in the painting. I suddenly had that thought to myself. I'm like, I just beat Max. What if I can't? What if I am focusing and I am choosing this life?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, that occurred to me when I was sitting around for the hour and a half after I had to tap out, because I started thinking about the bad tweets by J.D. Vance tweets you told me about as we were walking in the studio, which incredible competitive spirit.
Literally tweeting at J.D. Vance, then tweeted, then told Max about how angry I was about my tweet at J.D. Vance, and then we started recording.
Yeah, tell me about it right before we had to do the focus challenge. That's that winner's spirit that gets you there. No, so, okay, so the painting that we used is specifically from a page of the New York Times set up last year where it tests how long you can look at a painting that is meant to demonstrate for you how badly your focus has been fractured. And this comes from an assignment that an art history professor named Jennifer Roberts gives her students, where she asks all of her students to look at a work of art for 3 hours. Now, you and I tapped out at, what was it, 2 minutes and 4 minutes?
3 hours?
I know. Incredible. So the painting that they...
I would rather...
What would you rather do?
I'm thinking about Chris's book, and we don't talk about this, so I can tell the story. But like in his book, he talks about an experiment where they put people in a room by themselves. Mm-hmm. And
I know this. It's great.
And you can either stay there by yourself and do nothing, or you can give yourself a shock. You could mm-hmm. administer yourself a small shock just to feel something, not be with alone with your own thoughts.
To have stimulation.
And people do the shock.
A lot.
A lot.
In fact, some people
and way
like
more
lean
men
on
than
the
women
button,
do
right?
the shock, too.
I remember that. Yes. It's an incredible, an incredibly disturbing experiment that is like, it's shocking, but you're like, of course.
Of course.
And then you start to think, would I shock myself? And I'm like, I would probably shock myself a little bit because I don't have a Twitter feed in front of me.
Oof.
Anyway, the painting they picked is the opposite of, I would say, shocking yourself. It's a painting by Whistler, Nocturne in Blue and Silver. It's from 1943, which is kind of perfect because it's this impressionistic landscape of a coastline where it doesn't, it's made up of these very subtle little details that don't have any significance until you look at it for a few minutes. It's a painting that is not rewarding unless you have the focus to spend several minutes kind of absorbing these little teeny tiny details.
Oh.
And the fact that it's just from the 40s, from our grandparents' lifetimes, I think goes to show how much that focus has changed and the fact that our brains work very differently than they do today. So we're using it as kind of a metric, but also as a way to remind ourselves that we're not good at focusing anymore, like as a species.
And we're gonna come back to that painting at some point, right?
I think the idea is that every week we're gonna come back to it, so that's like
until we hit 3 hours.
I mean, listen, I would love to get to 3 hours. It's kind of like our focus is a muscle in our brains, and this painting test is seeing how much our attention can bench press every week. It's arm day for our brains, for our attentions. Yeah, which is not because it's important to look at paintings, but because having that focus is better for leading an actualized life.
So in addition to the painting, we're also going to be tracking our sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Why sleep? And how have you been sleeping?
So it's not great. Not great. since the election. So the last couple of weeks especially, I've been down to like 4 or 5 hours a night because I'm doom spiraling. Everything that erodes your focus also erodes your sleep. So it's a very useful benchmark. And then at the same time, better or worse sleep also leads to better or worse focus. It's just at the foundation of a lot of your brain being able to do the things that you want it to do, and that's having control, and having like the hormones that you have in your brain are more like, it's more adrenaline if you've slept less, so it's harder for you to focus. So if we can improve sleep, we'll probably improve everything else.
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just a different, like, explains biochemically. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Because you're on that fight or flight when you haven't slept as much. So last week, like I said, I was clocking like 4 or 5 hours. We have been tracking our sleep on apps. I believe you have an app on your phone.
Yeah.
What do you have?
Em and I were talking about this before because she did it too. But like, I found that just using the app gave me worse sleep because it was hard to believe that the app sleep score. We have sleep score.
Yeah.
And you put it on the nightstand next to your bed.
Creepy.
And somehow it like knows when you're doing deep sleep, less deep sleep. So the whole night I was like, is this really going to work? And so I just kept being like, anyway, my score was a 79.
Okay. Out of 100, that's great.
Yeah, but I logged like, what was it? Hold on, sorry.
What it's scoring five on is not just hours of sleep, but it's deep sleep. It's the quality of your sleep.
Sleep duration, 5 hours and 50 minutes.
Really? Oh, man. That's not great. You're supposed to get 8.
You are supposed to get 8. Yeah, I did not.
So I have been, so I got a Fitbit because I don't, sorry to be snooty, don't bring my phone into the bedroom. Mm-hmm. So I wear a Fitbit to bed now to track my sleep.
Okay.
And I had the exact same experience with you where this is the device that's supposed to help you track your sleep so you can get better at sleeping. And instead, I have been having stress dreams about the Fitbit sleep score not being high enough. I literally had a nightmare that woke me up through the day where I was looking at the Fitbit sleep score and was watching the number go down, and it stressed me out so much that I woke up and lost sleep. So
sounds like it's working already.
I am averaging 67 out of 100, and I've been getting about 6.5 hours, but I'm aiming for 8.
Aiming for 8. If I get to 7, I'd be thrilled.
Well, I don't have kids, so I'm coming from a position of luxury.
I can't even blame them last night. They were actually both angels last night. I just couldn't sleep.
Yeah. Well, something that I think I'm also going to be watching for myself is how long does it take me to fall asleep, which is partly a focus thing because it's your brain spiraling. And when I wake up, am I awake for 3 minutes or am I awake for 2 hours?
Yep. That's my biggest issue. The other thing we're going to do is track our phone pickups.
Right, because it's a measure of how many times we are involuntarily reaching for our phone.
Yes. And so last week, my average was 276 times per day.
Oh my God.
I picked up my phone.
I will say that at least 4 of those have been during this recording. So I can see why those numbers are what they are. I'm at 88, which is still a wild number. It's still so much. So I don't want people to think 88 is low because it is not. It's just that 276?
276.
Woof.
See if I can get that thing done, huh? All right, so what are we doing this week? Walk us through the challenge.
This week's challenge is inspired by our pal Chris Hayes. We're calling it the Chris Hayes Method, a daily walk, 20 minutes, no screens.
20 minutes,
2-0. No headphones. That's it. It's 20 minutes. Just you, yourself, your thoughts, your brain, nothing to distract you, and just try to redevelop those muscles to be able to, because there's not going to be anything distracting you, can you control what you're thinking about and not say, do what I'm going to do the first few times, which is just doom spiral about the news, and like actually kind of try to direct my own thoughts in the absence of all of that stimulus.
And this is once a day? We're doing this?
Once a day, 20 minutes.
Oof. Okay.
It's going to be great.
All right. All right. In a minute, you'll hear my conversation with Chris Hayes on the war for our attention. But before we jump to that, just quick housekeeping. There's a ton of rage bait in the news right now meant to distract and overwhelm us. Today, we'd like to focus on something positive, the work being done to fight back and what you can do to help. This month, Vote Save America is making donations as part of their anxiety relief program to Black-led organizations and candidates of color, helping us gain ground at the state and local level, like Kimberly Pope Adams, who's running for a Virginia State House seat this year. Prime opportunity to expand the Democrats' one-seat majority. You can set up a recurring donation at any amount that feels right for you, and Vote Save America will use it to build progressive power in 2025 and beyond. Go to votesaveamerica.com/donate to donate now. Paid for by Vote Save America, votesaveamerica.com. Not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee. Up next, Chris Hayes. Offline is brought to you by Armra Colostrum. Everyone's looking for ways to be healthier and stave off winter illnesses. Give your immunity and gut health their best chance with Armra Colostrum. Discover the transformational health benefits of Armra Colostrum that have earned tens of thousands of five-star reviews. Probiotics and other supplements are touted as a gut health solution, but most products on the market are dead before they even reach your gut. Armra Colostrum naturally fortifies your entire gut wall system and optimizes your whole body microbiome, which helps guard against irritants that can trigger digestive issues and compromise your immune system. Research has shown that colostrum helps to enhance nutrient absorption. Armra Colostrum can help stabilize blood sugar levels, modulate hormones, and ignite your metabolism. This enhanced nutrient absorption has been a closely guarded secret of elite athletes. Colostrum has been shown to promote lean muscle building and fuel cellular repair regeneration to fuel better performance and faster recovery. The bioactives in Armra Colostrum have also been shown to aid in reactivating hair follicle stem cells and activating collagen production, promoting hair growth, and enhancing skin radiance. We've worked out a special offer for my audience. Receive 15% off your first order. Go to tryarmra.com/offline or enter offline to get 15% off your first order. That's tryarmra.com/offline.
Hi, I'm Alex Wagner. I do not need to tell you that being an American right now is a wild ride. But as a longtime journalist, I am not interested in the noise or the fear-mongering. I'm interested in the stories at the heart of the headlines. That is why every week on my show, Runaway Country, I'm joined by folks in the middle of the crossfire. From disillusioned MAHA moms to newly fired immigration judges to Epstein victims themselves, to understand what it means to live through this political chaos as an actual human being. And now I'm excited to tell you that Runaway Country is available ad-free to Friends of the Pod subscribers. Friends of the Pod is a subscription that supports the work Crooked does as an independent media company and gives you a ton of great bonus and ad-free content. With the midterms approaching, you are going to need more content to keep you sane. And now you can find Runaway Country right there. Subscribe now at crooked.com/friends.
Chris Hayes, welcome to Offline.
It's great to be here. In person, IRL.
In person.
Offline and IRL.
Perfect. Perfect for this conversation. I love this book.
Thanks. I really
Siren's Call.
It.
It's so good.
Thanks, man.
I thought I would like it, and I liked it even more.
That's great to hear.
And it's great to be talking about attention here on the third week of Trump the Sequel, which we can get to.
Feels pretty relevant.
I know. So I emailed you this, but I think the argument you make is the skeleton key to understanding, I don't know, the last few decades of what's happened to our politics, our culture, our minds. The reason I think it's important is because your analysis of living in the age of attention goes deeper than the problems we talk about on the show that we have with phones, with screen time, with social media. And your view is that the critique of the attention economy actually doesn't go far enough.
Yeah.
And you write, "My contention is that the defining feature of this age is that the most important resource, our attention, is also the very thing that makes us human." Just to give people who might not know what that means a quick explanation, why is attention the most important resource right now? And why is it the very thing that makes us human?
Great. So why it's the most important resource, I think, has to do with the structure of American economy and society and what we call the information age. Mm-hmm. We all sort of intuitively grasp, it's conventional wisdom that like we had an industrial economy and now we have an information economy. And we used to move atoms around through manufacturing. Now we move bits around, right? So and I think we all get that. The key insight, I think, is that information is not actually the valuable resource of the information age. Information is finite and replicable. There's maybe 100 firms that have my data and information, or maybe 1,000, but it doesn't really matter to me personally. So information isn't the key scarce resource. In 1972, Herb Simon, a brilliant political theorist and economist, gave this lecture called "Designing Decision-Making for Organizations in an Information-Rich World." And his key insight is that information actually consumes something, and what information consumes is attention. And this key insight, which is a 50-year-old insight, is really, to me, the kind of skeleton's key. Because once you think, okay, information is really important to this economy, there's more information than ever, that information is competing for something scarce and consuming something scarce, which is attention, all of a sudden it's like, oh, right, it's actually the attention age. It's the information is key, but the thing that we have to that is being competed for is the attention. And the way that I describe it in the book, I use a metaphor that Lawrence Lessig used in a book about intellectual property, where if your neighbor steals your idea of having a picnic table in your backyard mm-hmm. and puts his own picnic table in his backyard, it doesn't really affect your life. Like, but if he steals your picnic table, now you've got a real problem.
Yeah.
Information is like the idea of the picnic table. Attention is the picnic table. If your attention is taken, it can't be copied. It can't be replicated. If someone takes it, they have it and you don't. So that's the key sort of insight of like why it's so important now. And then the part of what it makes us human is our consciousness is the ability to direct the beam of thought where we want it to go. That's attention. That faculty is the faculty that defines us as conscious human creatures. Mm. And if people are taking it from us, we've lost dominion over our own mind.
And it's what makes us unique as social animals.
Absolutely.
Right? I thought that's so interesting about information and attention, because we are also a generation that has now known what it was like before the information age, growing up that way, and now are very much in it.
Yes.
And it made me realize, like, yeah, when we first, you know, when there is the internet and we went online, there was like all this information. It was great. It's like, now I'm going to be able to know everything. And now there's so much information that we've all experienced the challenge of figuring out, okay, what information do I need? When do I need it? How much do I need?
And even that, like, we're basically the same cohort. And I think that our cohort experience is kind of key to some of these insights mm-hmm. precisely because of what we went through. And the sort of experience, this sort of feeling of adventure that was the early internet, which is like the feeling you have where you land somewhere new that you're visiting as a traveler and like you get out of the hotel and you're like, okay, yeah, what are we going to go do? Like, that's how the internet felt. And now the feeling is like the feeling of car sickness and stuck in traffic.
Yes.
It's like the complete opposite sensation feeling of like vertigo, woozy, like kind of like not quite in your right body. And it's just, it is a 180 from that thrilling feeling of adventure.
No, I mean, I'm sure you feel this as well, but as I prepare for every Pod Save America, I feel like if I just keep reading the news and read everything there is on the internet about the news that we're going to talk about on the show, I will be prepared.
Yeah.
And that's insane.
Yeah.
Right? So like I've transitioned from, I'm like, all right, I read the stuff that I need to know, and now I need to just think about how I feel about the news that I read.
And that the taking space, I mean, this is something I write about in the book, and this idea of being comfortable just sitting with your own thoughts, and how that's an old problem for humans. It's part of the human condition. It's part of what the Buddha is wrestling with in 600 BCE. It's Pascal writes about it in the 17th century. Like, this is not just an attention age problem, but it's a human problem, but it's one so exacerbated by the attention age, where we acclimate to conditions where we have endless diversion, a bounty of diversion before us. And the more diversion you have, the more diversion you need. Mm-hmm. And it's never enough. And so when it's taken away, everyone has had the feeling of you double park the car, you put the hazards on, you go in to get a cup of coffee, you're like four people deep in a line, you pat your pocket, your phone's not there, and it's like, oh my God, I'm screwed. What am I going to do?
What am I going to do?
Well, I'm just going to be here waiting on this line with my own goddamn thoughts.
You know, like, I can't.
And it's like that flare of panic. But the other thing is, like, you know, you read biographies of like Einstein, and he's just like taking 2-hour walks in Princeton every day. Thinking stuff, just thinking it up. And it's like, that's how thoughts happen.
My New Year's resolution for last year was to go on a 20-minute walk every day with nothing.
Yeah.
No headphones, no nothing, and didn't do it like once. Maybe I did it once, and then I was like, okay, I'm not going to look at the phone, and I'll just listen to a podcast, and I feel like that was enough.
Right.
But it's not.
Well, and that's partly because of this acclimation. It can be unwired. Like, I actually do the 20 minutes. I really am religious about 20 minutes with only my thoughts every day at some point, which is like my one little news you can use part of this book is like, do that. Just find a way to do 20 minutes every day. And that can be your commute, where you like just drive and don't listen to something.
Yeah.
And you let your thoughts marinate, or I do it on a walk because I live close to a park. I take my dog. But it you know, that reacclimating to that condition. And to go back to your original point about the sort of generational cohort, like we are the generation, the last generation that like read the cereal box.
Which I heard you talking about that with Ezra, and I was like, oh my God. It was like the first time I had remembered doing that. But I used to do it all the time.
Of course. It's like, what copy is there in my visual field? And they would do, there would be little thing, you know, there'd be little things on the back because that was, and so I think that also, because we experience that sort of dearth to, you know, overload experience that we're keyed into it.
We've talked a lot on this show about how social media gives us the illusion of connection with other people. You described this dynamic, and I thought a really smart way, which is that humans seek recognition, but what we get from social media is attention. Can you talk about the difference between recognition and attention and why social media tends to give us the latter and not the former?
So social attention is a strange thing. Like, we need social attention to survive from the moment that we're born. But it's attention in so many spheres, it's a theme of the book, is necessary but not sufficient. It's like, you want something more than social attention from other people. You want love, consideration, care, friendship, camaraderie, all these things. And fundamentally, as humans, what we seek is recognition, which is to be seen as human by another human. That is what we want. You can't get that from social media because the person who's noticing you, you fundamentally can't see them as human. And they can't really see you as human unless there's an actual relationship. People do create relationships online that become human. But the sort of social attention from strangers is this like synthetic adjacent form that gives you a little bit of the taste of recognition, but none of this, like the fulfillingness of it. Well, so you sort of snack on it, right?
It's like a reciprocity that you're looking for. And it is
right. I mean, reciprocity is what relationships are made of. That's the weird thing about taking the covalent bond of relationships that are formed through mutual social attention and separating them into different vectors of like, I pay attention to you, you pay attention to me, and then distributing them at scale such that now none of those things are synced up or matched.
It is funny because a while back now, I changed my Twitter settings so that I only saw notifications and comments and everything from people that I follow.
That's an enormously important change.
Right? And so, but now I look at it and it's very funny because I'm like, you know, scrolling and I look and there's not much there. And then I see some people that I know because I follow them who'll just like a tweet. And I'm like, well, it's nice that they liked the tweet, but that's all I get. It's nothing. There's no conversation. There's no nothing. And like you start feeling, and then you go, and then I'm like, now I'm going to go back to the tweet and see if there's any angry comments.
Yes.
Because maybe I'm going to, the angry comment is something, even though it's not.
That's
like, what the fuck? That's crazy.
That's the sick part.
Yeah.
If you can't, where it's like, if you can't get anything else, you'll take attention. And the other thing that's important about social attention as a kind of feature of this sort of framework is the weird thing about social attention is it has no valence, positive or negative. Like someone screaming in your face on the subway is social attention.
Right.
Someone like flirting with you across the bar is also social attention. Yep. They're both attention. Like one is far more pleasurable than the other. But in the absence of attention and when we're conditioned to respond to attention qua attention, you get a lot of pathological seeking of negative attention.
Yeah.
Just this kind of troll addiction. And that's not, you know, that may sound like,
Leads you right to the White House.
Well, that was the point I was going to make. It's like, you may be like, well, that's kind of that's true. But like, we have watched this break the brains of some of the most powerful people in the world and produced a model of public discourse that is now 100% the dominant model of both the most powerful man in the world who runs the most powerful military named Donald Trump and the richest man in the world who also seems to be maybe running the country. And both of them have this as a core part of their personalities now.
Which, and I want to talk about this later, but like, which is basically the perfect logical conclusion of the attention age these two at the top.
I mean,
like you couldn't have
absolute. Like, and I did a final read of the book back in, you know, because books have a long lead time. And I did my final read, it must have been maybe back in the summer. Like we were sort of locking the book. And I was like, there's a lot of Musk in this book. Is there too much Musk? And it was because he was such the perfect figure of this. There's this guy where like all of these pathologies and deformative, they've clearly kind of broken his brain. They've changed his behavior. He bought this thing for $44 billion so he could be the main character on it.
Yep.
And then I was like, no, actually, he is pretty central. And now it's like, I didn't even get to write about everything that came after the manuscript was locked.
He is a genius whose brain has been rotted by the very platform that he purchased.
Yes,
which is just one of the many stories.
Exactly correct.
So here's a problem I've encountered. There's people like you and I who spend way too much of our lives online, but at least recognize the damage it's doing to us. Then there's people who spend way too much of their lives online, but like deeply believe still that it's a good thing. It makes them feel happy, connected, important part of their
life. Is that true?
I think about the intense reaction to the TikTok ban briefly going into effect.
Yes.
Because TikTok decided to. And I wonder, I'm like, I have to check myself because I'm like, are we missing something? Are we just like old guys, like out on our lawn yelling at the kids? And if we're not missing anything, like what? Is it hard to recognize this if you're so addicted to the algorithms? And I think TikTok's probably the worst example of this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the most powerful for sure. I think that's the most kind of weaponized version of it.
And the least reciprocal.
Yes, although then there's this very weird thing that happens on TikTok, which I think is like an incredibly unhealthy thing of like taking the comment and posting it and responding to it.
Yes.
Which is a very, very perverse and dysfunctional version of discourse.
Very.
It's even worse than Twitter dunking somehow, and yet it is, of course, like a main trope.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my feeling about this is, I guess, the following. One is, there is a little bit of a baby in a bathwater issue here, which is, I love the internet. I've always loved the internet.
Same.
And I love lots of stuff on TikTok, because when the internet is at its best, what it is doing is aggregating and curating and leading you to discover the sheer talent brilliance of people.
Mm.
People being funny and smart and clever, and people who don't have comedy writing jobs but are working in a liquor store.
Right.
And people who are not professional dancers but can really dance. And, you know, there is so much talent creativity out there that one of the incredible things about the internet is to run through the gatekeepers that create sort of formal systems in which people are able to utilize their talents and instead kind of distribute it. When that is happening, that's great. Like, I love that. And honestly, earlier TikTok was a lot like that. And then as it got more, as it sort of grew, the same thing happened to it that happens in all these competitive attentional markets, which is driving towards conflict, driving towards like clips of old office shows, like,
and it's incredibly individualized. Like,
yes,
I find. And sort of the way that I came to TikTok is friends in the group chat, which you write about in the book, like sending a funny TikTok around. Because like,
and you're like, oh, that's cool.
All that cool stuff that you're talking about that's done on the internet, it's meant to be enjoyed with other people and talked about with other people.
Which is why sharing is so key. I mean,
this episode is out on the day of the Super Bowl, right? Which is maybe the last monocultural,
the last thing we got,
or the biggest, and one of the last monocultural events. And you know, Trump's there, and Taylor Swift, and you know, it's like, and so you got like sports
Trump's
fans
gonna be there,
sports fans, political thing, a music thing, like it's all there, it's all happening at the Super Bowl. But I do think, and we've talked about this for a while on the show, that like we are losing the monoculture is not just a like nostalgic, oh well, like I think it's there's something deeply problematic about that in just having a functioning society.
Yeah, I do. And it's funny because, again, this is one of those places, like, you know, you got to keep testing yourself. Am I the old guy? Get off my lawn. So like, just to close that thought, and like, I think there's a baby in bathwater thing. I understand why people like certain aspects of TikTok and these platforms. It's the specific structural mechanisms by which they monetize attention.
Yeah.
As opposed to the technological ability to do this thing that is the problem. You know what I mean?
Like, because you could have the latter.
You could. Like, and we've had, you know, email is messed up for a lot of reasons and it's, you know, spam.
Mm.
But it's an open protocol that, like, it's not, like, you can send email to anyone and there's lots of reasons email is a great technology, right? In terms of the monoculture, that's another place where it's interesting because if you go back and you look at the media criticism, particularly around the 30s and the rise of fascism, right? They've got the opposite problem of hyper-individuation. They've got the mob and masses, right? So it's like when you have these small channels that everyone hears, if the wrong people take them over and start the radio broadcast that the entire nation listens to with propaganda, that's really scary.
Well, you write about this. This is sort of like Orwell versus Huxley,
Huxley,
the
yeah.
Postman that Neil Postman
yeah.
writes about,
yeah.
right? Which is like mass communication as a problem, or just everyone not paying attention.
Yes, that yeah. Postman's insight is that he's writing this in 1984, the dystopia described by Orwell in 1984, which is information controlled by a single entity, is not the dystopia we got. Instead, it's Brave New World of Aldous Huxley, where there's just endless pleasures and delights and distraction, and no one actually pays any attention to important things.
Yeah, and now there's that, and there was that in the TV age, but now there's that, but it's like all of us in our own individual, you know, algorithmic drip.
Exactly.
For each of us, right? And so we're not even connecting.
And all of us, you know, people spending more time alone, which is a key part of this, and then the fusing of offline and online life is a huge part of this. Like, I remember this sort of slogan we used to use back in the day of like, Twitter's not real life. And one of the things I think was really clear in this last election is that like, you really can't distinguish
yeah.
real life and not real life. If, you know, if you're in a public place and you look around, ordinary people, what are they doing?
Yeah.
You know, in real life, they're looking at their phone. What is on the phone? The stuff on the internet. Well, what's the, you know, that's where they're getting information. That's how they're learning about the world.
Yeah. I could spend an entire episode talking with you about how the attention age shapes the decisions people in media like us make about what to talk about, what to cover. I want to zero in on a point that that you make that I think a lot of people who aren't in media understandably don't get, which is that the process of directing people's attention isn't just a one-way street.
Yes.
And the audience has a say in what we cover.
Yes.
Because if what we cover doesn't capture their attention, they will simply direct their attention somewhere else. And I think a lot of folks think, well, this is, it's about ratings and money and all the financial model is,
yeah.
does depend on that. But even if money wasn't part of it, if I'm saying something and you're not paying attention, what does it matter that I'm saying?
It's funny when some people would be like a critique of like, well, you're just trying to get ratings. It's like, yes, a lot. I'm trying to get a lot of people to pay attention to what
right.
I'm saying.
Which
is another way of saying
because
that.
I think it's what I'm saying, you know, could make a difference
yes,
some,
like,
in some
I would,
way.
I would like as many people as possible to hear what I'm saying. That is true. Like right. guilty as charged. And I think that's that feeling. You know, when you're inside media, you always feel like you're chasing.
Mm-hmm.
You're chasing the horse. And people outside media see us as riding the horse.
Yes.
Leading it. And
how do you balance that? Like, in a typical day when you're trying to figure out what's in the show, how do you balance the need to direct people's attention, but also, you know, follow where the audience is?
Sometimes it's, you know, today, like sometimes it's as sort of crude as a few blocks of following and a few blocks of leading, you know?
Yeah.
And look, sometimes you're in a situation where the place where there's attentional energy around is really important.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Musk thing is both a great story. I mean,
yeah.
not great in like, it's, you know, it's not, it's
an
bad,
interesting story,
but I mean like it's sort of narrative components. There's this character, the world's richest man, is like infiltrating the payment systems of the Treasury Department. And also is really important. So that's, those are kind of the easiest days, right? When it's right in the middle of the Venn diagram. But then we're also going to do something on the acting U.S. attorney in D.C., Ed Martin, who has really flown on the radar.
That fucking guy.
But yes, but people should be directing their attention to. So, you know, there's certain ways where you, through the monologue, you start in one place where you're trying to sort of capture people on what they're paying attention to, and then you kind of move them from that place somewhere else, and then you end up on a guest on a thing that's under the radar and not getting a lot of attention, but you started.
Yep.
You know, that's a classic Rachel Maddow trick, and she sort of does it better than anyone, but I've learned how to do it pretty well myself. So there's different ways, what you can't do is just ignore.
No.
Where attention is flowing.
No. But it is, it's funny, and you have,
I mean, you see it in your, I'm sure you guys,
well, I was gonna
see
say
it,
you have yeah. a podcast as well, so you know this, but when we started, like the data for podcasting is like notoriously thin, right? It's like yeah.
It's not great for
it's,
TV
it's
too.
It's gotten
either.
Better, but it's like still largely a black box. But at the beginning we were like, you know, we were checking out how many, first of all, we didn't even know how many downloads we were getting when
right.
we were over at The Ringer. And then we started this and we're like, oh, we check it once in a while. But you know, it's an ad model and it wasn't like completely dependent. So we would just like not pay attention to it and we just say whatever we wanted.
Yeah.
And then the show grew and it was great.
Yeah.
And then you get to a point where you're like, okay, here's how many downloads we have each show and should we listen? And there's the financial issues and the ads and all that kind of stuff. And then, but what I've realized too is if you try to completely shape the content with the thought in mind that you have to like get more downloads, it doesn't work.
That's a failure. No,
it just doesn't work. It's not even like it's bad. It just doesn't work.
That is really an important point too. You can't reverse engineer things off of the data. I mean, some people maybe can. I can't. And what I've done is, I think I've just developed a sense that's like a craft sense or almost like a surfer in the wave sense where it's like, I just know it at some point in my, you know, I just know where
you
the
just
energy
have a feel
is.
For
I
it.
Have a feel for where the energy is, but I'm,
because you're on the devices, just looking at all the news all the time.
I have this magical feel. It's called reading the internet all day long. It's a mystical quality. No. And you know, and I feel the same way. Like I stopped looking at ratings in 2020 during COVID, and I've never looked at them since, and I have no idea.
Oh,
that's good. 5 years, I have no idea. And it's, I think, so much better for the show.
Yeah.
And ironically, probably the ratings.
Offline is brought to you by Mosh. The older you get, the more you may find yourself wanting to be more intentional about the way you live, eat, and take care of your body. Mosh, which you may have heard about on Shark Tank, was founded by Maria Shriver and her son Patrick Schwarzenegger with a simple mission: to create a conversation about brain health through food, education, and research. Maria's father suffered from Alzheimer's, and since she and Patrick have dedicated themselves to finding ways to help other families dealing with this debilitating disease. Mosh joined forces with the world's top scientists and functional nutritionists to go beyond your average protein bar with 8 delicious flavors, including a plant-based one in peanut butter and chocolate. Each Mosh bar is made with ingredients that support brain health, like ashwagandha, lion's mane, collagen, and omega-3s. Mosh is now the first and only food brand boosted with Cognizant, a premium nootropic that supplies the brain with the patented form of citicoline. But here's the best part: to make you feel good, Mosh donates a portion of all proceeds from your order to fund gender-based brain health research through the Women's Alzheimer's Movement. Love Mosh bars. Whenever they're in the office, they go really quickly because everyone loves them because they taste delicious. And, you know, I've tried a lot of protein bars. I would recommend Mosh. If you want to find ways to give back to others and fuel your body and your brain, Mosh bars are the perfect choice for you. Head to moshlife.com/offline to save 20% off plus free shipping on the bestsellers trial pack. That's 20% off plus free shipping on the bestsellers trial pack at moshlife.com/offline. Thank you, Mosh, for sponsoring this episode.
Hi, I'm Alex Wagner. I do not need to tell you that being an American right now is a wild ride. But as a longtime journalist, I am not interested in the noise or the fear-mongering. I'm interested in the stories at the heart of the headlines. That is why every week on my show, Runaway Country, I'm joined by folks in the middle of the crossfire. From disillusioned MAHA moms to newly fired immigration judges to Epstein victims themselves, to understand what it means to live through this political chaos as an actual human being. And now I'm excited to tell you that Runaway Country is available ad-free to Friends of the Pod subscribers. Friends of the Pod is the subscription that supports the work Crooked does as an independent media company and gives you a ton of great bonus and ad-free content. With the midterms approaching, you are going to need more content to keep you sane. And now you can find Runaway Country right there. Subscribe now at crooked.com/friends.
I've been thinking about this a lot since the election. How do you think about ways to reach people beyond the people that all of us are already talking to, and we're all on the team? We've decided, you know, like we're thinking a lot alike, especially about politics. And I mean, it's a little, I still have my, you know, Democratic strategist organizer hat on, but I wonder for you, as you're thinking like, okay, we got to reach more people. How do you think about that on a day-to-day basis? Or is that the conversation you want to be having?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's two ways to understand the we. Like, in a specific sense of me as Chris Hayes, who has a podcast and a television show, or like people with my politics, or like the Democratic Party, which is not really my Democratic Party has to do its own thing. I'm not structurally part of it. I think different platforms or different forms of media matter. Like, we launched the podcast, Why Is This Happening? In part, and I see it at book signings where there is a different group of people that listen to the podcast and watch the show.
Yeah.
Partly that's an age thing, mm-hmm. of younger people listen to podcasts and watch less cable news. So that's part of it. I mean, watching Jamel Bowie like blow up on TikTok has been a delight, you know, because it's like, and even people, he has some funny things where people are like, who's this TikTok guy? And it's like, I'm a columnist in the New York Times. It's like, it's the, like, one of the five most important writing jobs in the English language, maybe, probably. Like, and it's just so funny because it's like, right, that's a different audience. So part of what I'm trying to say is there are structural boundaries around who listens to what kind of media or consumes what kind of media that you cannot unilaterally overcome.
Yeah.
Like, I can't get 25-year-olds en masse to watch linear cable news.
Right.
I can't do it. I could make amazing content, and it's just not going to happen because of the structural impediments. So part of that also is like putting our clips out on Instagram Reels and putting it out on TikTok and doing that sort of thing. The other thing I would say is one of the things I really like about the podcast is we don't just talk about politics. We talk about a lot of different things. I think that's really important when people talk about this Joe Rogan on the left idea.
Yeah.
You know, talk about other stuff and your worldview and values can inform that, but it's not.
Right.
Let's talk about this special election in Nebraska that's coming up.
All the time.
Yeah. So I think that's part of it too. But to your point, let me just say one more thing. One, the research data we have shows that there's actually more heterogeneous viewership of our show than you would guess.
Mm.
Like, people who describe themselves as conservatives watch our show.
We get that. We get people coming up to us and be like, oh, I listen to you guys and Ben Shapiro.
Yeah.
I'm like, what?
I got this guy in my neighborhood who's like the world's biggest Steve Bannon fan, who's just always saying, like, I love your show. He's like, you and Bannon. I'm like, all right, man.
Yeah, whatever
floats your boat. But I think that this idea, the political question here is a Democratic Party getting caught in audience capture. And that's really what we're getting at, right? Which is saying things that the people that are your most fervent supporters want to hear from you, but are in tension with the messages that will reverberate in the outer part of the concentric circle where elections are won and lost, particularly presidential elections, in a universe in which low propensity voters are drifting away from you. And that is a real conundrum.
I mean, to me, that's the biggest conundrum.
It's the biggest conundrum.
One of the reasons I loved your book so much is you articulated the problem that I have been worried about for a long time, even before the results of the election, which is I have thought for a while that the central political challenge of our time is living in a society where, as you say, attention is the most valuable resource. And I worry that that is basically incompatible with living in a functioning democracy at this point. Because I think that,
that's the worry.
Like, nearly every incentive that you write about advantages authoritarian movements, right?
Yeah.
Like, our tendency to pay attention to the most lurid stories, crime.
Threat, particularly.
Threat, scandals, tendency of lies to grab more attention than truth. Public debate and discourse has become nearly impossible.
Yep.
You write that it's like trying to meditate in a strip club.
That's the line, yep.
It's perfect. And here's the big one. Donald Trump, during this campaign, he would say a couple times, like, vote for me and you'll never have to vote again. And, you know, and we all scream, look, he's telling us there won't be elections again. But I think part of what he was saying there and part of why it was appealing to people is, if you vote for me, I will take care of everything and you won't have to pay attention to the boring shit anymore.
That's
and
exactly
to all
right.
this like messy.
Yes.
And we're and Democrat, we're like, pay attention to this important thing and it's hard and it's messy.
Totally.
And you might be disappointed sometime, but just your precious attention, which you don't have much of, we want you to direct it to this boring endeavor.
Yeah.
Because you know it's gonna help people and you wanna help people. But I don't know, this other guy, he's telling you, you can go back to just having fun and watching TikTok and I'll take care of it all. And like, I don't know how to get beyond that.
I think all that's right, that the trends are in the wrong direction. But I also think that, you know, talent and innovation matter a lot. And there are ways to do this in pro-social. I mean, the deck is stacked, surely, in favor of essentially reactionary forms of attention capture.
Yes.
In the same way, like we see this in, we've seen this, you know, competitive attention markets, what do they select for, right? Casinos, Times Square, the tabloid space of a supermarket, which is a very competitive little market for your eyeball attention, right? It's lurid. It's often false.
Yep.
The lead of evening news is often like, if it bleeds or leads, like what's that? Well, threat, danger, right? Competitive attention market. So those all have reactionary entailments. But the other thing is like being a really good public communicator, wanting to dominate attention matters a lot,
yeah.
Which a lot of Democrats do not want to do. Does Dick Durbin want everyone talking about Dick Durbin all the time? Dick Durbin does not want everyone talking about Dick Durbin all the time.
You know, like, what? He's mission accomplished.
Yeah, that's not shade on Dick Durbin.
No, I know.
In fact, to be honest, people that don't want people talking about them all the time are
probably more normal.
Normal and decent people who like want to do their work. Like, so you need people that want the attention, that understand it's important to get it, and then you need people to try lots of different things to get it that might be weird or wacky or not what other people have done before.
Yeah.
But part of the genius of the algorithm is that it can find stuff that no one would have given a green light to that people like.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the job in politics. I mean, Barack Obama is a pretty good example of this.
I know, but I've said this to former Obama colleagues many times in the last couple of years, which is, I wonder if he would win today.
I do too, but I think a version of him can. Like, I don't know if the—
I mean, if he can't, then I don't know who—
like, right.
But I mean, still think,
it's
like,
also, we're talking about 2.5 points in the swing states.
Right.
So, you know, can you get that margin? But— Yeah, I mean, I think you need people that are going to try stuff. That is the really important part of this.
Well, it's funny. I was listening to you and Ezra talk about this. And, you know, and I've heard this before, which is, you know, Republicans understand that it's not the type of attention you receive.
It's the
quantity of attention. And they're very good at getting negative attention. Donald Trump's very good at getting negative attention. Elon Musk is very good at getting negative attention. But, like, I think even if there were Democrats who mastered getting the amount of attention that Musk and Trump do, or and if some of it was negative, like, that doesn't work for our project, which is a Democratic project where we're trying to tell everyone, like, you know, democracy requires patience and hard work and grace and empathy and all these everything. We're like, we are working against everything. So when we try to get attention, even on the Democratic side, some of the people who get the most attention are the people who seem Trump-like.
Yes.
In some ways.
Yes, although I think there's different ways to do that. But yes, I mean, it pushes against the project, I think, of the kind of pressing the buttons that light up lizard brain. That is the sort of stock and trade. But I also think that you can, you know, there was a certain kind of virality to Barack Obama that was rooted in his unique abilities as a public communicator.
Mm.
That, but then kind of took on a kind of like viral aspect of their own. And I it's funny that like that was the critique of him. Like, he's a big celebrity in the Kane ad.
Now it's like, yeah, that's why he won.
Yeah, he was a big celebrity. Yeah, maybe try to run someone that everyone wants to be around and wants, like, thinks is cool.
Right.
That's an interesting idea. But part of that was him. Like, he had a unique set of skills. Part of it, of course, was his staff.
Right, of course.
Probably 70 to 80%.
Yeah, right.
And then part of it was just the kind of, like, weird vagaries of the viral updraft that happened. And I guess part of what I'm saying is, like, you got to try stuff and hope you kind of hit that lottery.
Yeah.
You know, and you don't know what that's going to be ahead of time, even though the deck is stacked and the game is kind of rigged. You know, Trump didn't know all this stuff was going to work.
No, he very much backed into most of this.
He backed into it, and a lot of it, you know, stuff did work. But, you know, if his polling had plummeted and he'd been abandoned after that first John McCain comment.
Yeah, well, that would be it.
The world would. Yeah, exactly. Like, the world would have just gone on a different track. I don't know what would have happened, but
yeah.
So part of it is just you need to try stuff. That I think is the one lesson here. And I think there is a real problem of, you see this across everything, of the center left in this country being hidebound and small c conservative.
Yeah.
Rear guard actions to defend institutions, defend the bureaucracy.
And it's, I don't think it's a coincidence that most of them come off as the most boring.
Yeah.
Politics.
Yeah, and defend the status quo. And that's not to say, like, right now it's important to defend institutions and bureaucracy, but also, like, a lot of institutions don't work well. A lot of things in the bureaucracy are broken. Like, if you talk to people who are up close to the bureaucracy, they can give you, I know people in the bureaucracy who are both, at one hand, terrified and appalled by what Musk and Trump are doing, and also can give you 2 hours
yep.
about everything that's broken in their specific part of their bureaucracy. And so this sort of small c conservatism, this kind of dependence on precedent, there's a lot of this kind of like retracted in thinking in progressive Democratic Party circles that I think is really a problem.
Well, it's interesting because I always, you know, like AOC, I think, is one of the best communicators yeah. in the party. And she, you know, her politics are a little to the left of mine, not yeah. much. But, you know, if every time I'm like, oh, she's one of the most talented communicators in the party, but it's like, well, look at her poll numbers. Like, she's so polarizing. And, you know, she's got one of the highest, you know,
negatives,
approval. Yeah, negatives or anyone. So I'm like, okay, well, but she's interesting. She can break through. She's communicating. And then as you get closer to the center, it's hard to think of a politician or a leader here or anywhere who can capture attention,
yeah.
but is like a center left,
yeah.
very electable figure.
Yeah.
And I don't know, like, we can go back and criticize Kamala Harris's campaign or right. Joe Biden or all of them, but like, we keep running into this.
Yeah. I mean, I think, yeah, it's hard to, it is hard to come up with that. I also think, like, okay, well, then just try stuff. Like,
yeah.
go be the centrist AOC. I don't know. Fetterman, yeah. is he kind of doing that, guess, in his own weird way?
I guess Pete, in a way.
Yeah.
Pete was a...
And yeah. Pete likes to... And the thing about him is that he likes attention, and he likes to go talk to people, and yeah. he likes to be on stuff, and that's an important part of it. But yeah, like, I don't know if the AOC model is the right one, but she is out there.
Yeah, and she's breaking through. Offline is brought to you by Hiya. Typical children's vitamins are basically candy in disguise, filled with 2 teaspoons of sugar, unhealthy chemicals, and other gummy additives growing kids should never eat. That's why Hiya created a super-powered, chewable vitamin. Hiya is made with zero sugar and zero gummy additives, yet it tastes great and is perfect for picky eaters. Hiya fills in the most common gaps in modern children's diets to provide the full-body nourishment our kids need with a yummy taste they love. Formulated with the help of pediatricians and nutritional experts, Hiya is pressed with a blend of 12 organic fruits and veggies, then supercharged with 15 essential vitamins and minerals, including vitamin D, B12, C, zinc, folate, and many others to help support immune system, energy, brain function, mood, concentration, teeth, bones, and more. Every single batch is third-party tested for heavy metals and microbials in a qualified GMP-compliant lab using scientifically validated testing methods, so you know the product is safe and nutritious. Charlie loves Hiya vitamins, and he is a picky eater, but we give him high vitamins and he eats them and they taste good, and we know that they're not super sugary. And are you tired of battling with your kids to eat their greens? Hiya now has Kids Daily Greens and Superfoods, a chocolate favored greens powder designed specifically for kids, packed with 55 plus whole food ingredients to support brain power, development, and digestion. Just scoop, shake, and sip with milk or any non-dairy beverage for a delicious and nutritious boost your kids will actually enjoy. We've worked out a special deal with Hiya for their best-selling children's vitamin. Receive 50% off your first order. To claim this deal, you must go to HiyaHealth.com/off. This deal is not available on their regular website. Go to HiyaHealth.com/off and get your kids the full-body nourishment they need to grow into healthy adults.
Hi, I'm Alex Wagner. I do not need to tell you that being an American right now is a wild ride. But as a longtime journalist, I am not interested in the noise or the fear-mongering. I'm interested in the stories at the heart of the headlines. That is why every week on my show, Runaway Country, I'm joined by folks in the middle of the crossfire. From disillusioned MAHA moms to newly fired immigration judges to Epstein victims themselves, to understand what it means to live through this political chaos as an actual human being. And now I'm excited to tell you that Runaway Country is available ad-free to Friends of the Pod subscribers. Friends of the Pod is the subscription that supports the work Crooked does as an independent media company and gives you a ton of great bonus and ad-free content. With the midterms approaching, you are going to need more content to keep you sane. And now you can find Runaway Country right there. Subscribe now at crooked.com/friends.
You mentioned Zelensky as like an example of a good attention merchant.
I had a
Why do you think that worked?
It's so funny. The original draft of this book had a 5,000-word prologue that was about the Ukraine war and Zelensky. And I cut it because it sort of felt like a weird place to start. But I think he's a fascinating figure because here's a guy whose professional life is how to get and maintain attention because he was a comedian.
Yes.
Then he wrote and starred in a show that is a attention age parable in which a substitute teacher in a high school goes on a rant about corruption in Ukraine while a student surreptitiously records him on a video. It gets uploaded and goes viral.
I forgot that was the show, launching
the teacher into an unlikely campaign for president, which he wins. That show is the biggest show in Ukraine by far. It's watched by like a third to a half of the country. He then trademarks the name of the party in the show as his own party and runs for president, having written a show about a viral dude running for president successfully and destroys the competition, then finds himself immediately after a few sort of stumbling years as a wartime president, like literally like ducking Russian bombs, and understands immediately that the single most important thing for the survival of his nation is to grab the attention of the world so as to convert that attention into arms and money to support their defense.
And I've been thinking about him since I read that in your book. And I do, like, there's sort of a moral clarity in his rhetoric. Like, I was trying to think of how he spoke and why he got so much attention. Part of it is just the circumstances he found himself in. But he was very good about, like, he wasn't trying to embellish things. He wasn't trying to do, like, push all the buttons you push when you're trying to go for the lizard brain stuff.
Yes.
It was just moral clarity. Putin is a murderous tyrant, and here are my people, and here are their stories, and I'm going to walk among them. Like, it was just, the story was good.
The story's good, but also the appetite to talk to people and communicate constantly.
That's true.
This is a big part
of it. He was everywhere.
He did Letterman in a metro station. I just saw him do an interview with Lex Fridman, the podcaster, and Fridman speaks fluent Russian, and they have this fascinating fraud exchange at the beginning where Fridman's speaking to him in Russian, and of course, Zelensky is from the Russian-speaking part of Ukraine and actually grew up speaking Russian as his, like, household language, but was explaining to Fridman why he won't use Russian now because of what it means at a moment when people speaking that mother tongue are killing his people. And it was this incredibly intense exchange. And this is something that I think there really is a, like, Zelensky talks to everyone. He does a lot of trying to get attention. López Obrador in Mexico, who was the only incumbent basically to buck the trend of incumbents around the world getting their butts kicked and passed off the presidency to his hand-chosen successor, Claudia Sheinbaum, who won by 30 points, was doing like 3 hours a day.
Yeah.
He gave away a watch on his last press conference to some kid. Narendra Modi, who's got 65% approval rating and is a reactionary and I think sort of aspiring autocrat, but he's doing like all sorts of crazy stunts where he's on TV all the time. Like,
well,
Trump has been on TV all day, every day. And I just like, I'm like, that part of it, I don't think has an ideological valence. I really don't. No. Like, yes, there's something a little kind of, there is something a little Caudillo-esque about the, I'm going to do 3 hour press conferences every day.
Yeah.
But you could do that as a liberal. You could. You could just do that as a liberal. You could be like, today we're doing this big thing, and I'm going to take questions, and I'm going to, like,
I think you
and I'm going to make news.
This is where the Zelensky comparison is interesting, too. I do think you have to, like, humor on our side helps,
hugely,
right?
Important.
You could be funny, entertaining, because you've got to be entertaining and hold the audience's attention without just being an asshole the whole time.
Yeah.
Because, again, that cuts against the actual project.
Yes. And you have to, the other thing that you have to, which is key, and this is about AOC and it's true about Pete, you have to, deep in the deepest part of your cells, enjoy doing it.
Yes.
If you are not enjoying doing it, it's not going to work. Like, you got to love it. You got to be, like, love being out there, love tussling with the press, love talking to people. And, you know, Joe Biden, for most of his career, that was true of Joe
Biden.
That, you know, like,
I actually think that was some of the charm that led him, you know, to the heights that.
And I think that I think a 65-year-old version of him might have had a very different experience of incumbency this time around and even, you know, running.
What do you think the political movement to sort of take back our attention collectively sounds like? I know you guys were talking about, like, there's a space for a candidate that runs against all this. And it's not just the phones, though that's part of it. But what is the vision for that kind of country sound like?
It's really interesting. I mean, I think it's regulating, going after the tech oligarchs is the kind of pressure point here.
Yeah.
We don't want these people that monetize our attention and exploit us to have all of the power concentrated in a few hands. And they're that, you know, taking them on.
And they are like sapping something from us that makes us alive, which is, I thought about that.
Cyber
Barons. Do you hear Steve Bannon talk to Ross Douthat, that podcast?
Yeah, yeah.
And it was interesting hearing the split between him and Musk, which is not just, you know, over immigration or anything like that, but his thought is basically Musk is a transhumanist and they all want to.
He hates the tech dudes.
Yeah, because but the reason why is he thinks, like, spiritually,
yes,
they are stealing something from all of us and they all want us to just, the robots to take over and put the chips in our brain and send us to Mars and whatever else. And, like, that's, you know, what makes us human is, you know, being together. And Steve Bannon, so I'm putting a nicer shine on what he said. But it did make me think that there is an opening that is cross ideological for people being like, enough of this shit.
And I also think Musk represents that right now.
Yes.
And I, you know, again, polling is not, you know, it is what it is.
Right.
But, you know, to the extent we can measure how the American public feels about this guy, it's plummeting. It's like truly falling off a cliff. And part of the thing that he doesn't have is he is not Donald Trump. He is not charismatic in the same way. He is not funny in the same way.
No.
He is like a vortex of negative charisma. I mean, he's just like the unfunniest dork that ever lived.
Which is why he's not on TV all the time.
That's the other thing is he can't, Trump could go out there and he can kind of defend himself and he can lie and he can change direction. Musk is just, there's a million stories being run about Musk and Musk is on his platform, which is where he sort of communicates, but it's just not the same of him being able to redirect. He's trying to on the platform he owns, but
all he can do is meme.
I think people are like, I don't like this dude. What? And I have found this out in the wild. I don't know if you have too, but the Musk thing is absolutely getting through to normies, that people that don't follow political news. And the initial visceral reaction is like, I don't know. He's in the payment. His 19-year-old can control Social Security payments? I don't know about that.
But also, like, it is the difference between Trump and Musk, because you meet people who've met Trump and they're saying, you know what? He's a gregarious guy,
yeah. Yeah,
and he's charming and stuff like that. And people who meet Elon Musk, they'll say, yeah, he's a genius. Everyone will say, he's fucking weird.
Weird dude.
No one's like, oh, he's so wonderful and generous to the staff. No one says that.
Weird dude.
So it's great coincidence that you're here this week because Max Fischer and I, Max, my co-host here, we did an offline challenge last year where we tried a bunch of things to reduce our screen time. With mixed results, at least for me. This week, we're starting another offline challenge that serendipitously has to do with reclaiming our attention. This is about trying to increase our focus.
I love this.
And so we're going to do a different challenge over the next couple of weeks. Any ideas or advice for the listeners besides the walk, which is a good one?
The walk is a good one. I also think these are sort of dumb and obvious points, but like the physical location of the phone matters a lot.
Yeah.
It just does. Where do you, like, have a place to plug it in that's far from where you hang out in the house. It just, you know, these little friction points, you know, there's these studies. I remember reading this back in college in some class about, like, public plazas. And if the stairs were, like, you know, over some amount, you know, 3 inches, and if they were over an inch, like, no one went up to the plaza.
Mm.
Just, like, a little bit of friction. So that kind of physical friction does really work.
Yeah.
For where, you know.
How are you finding, because I found this difficult even, and it's sort of getting used to the Trump era again. Like, I remember this from the first term. It feels worse this term.
It's
like.
It's worse.
You know, for our jobs, and a lot of people listening pay attention to the news, and, you know, they want their phones and their screens for that. But, like, how do you, found any ways to consume the news that are not just, like, fire hose?
No, like smoking 3 packs a day.
Okay,
no.
Cool.
I'm just like those, like, lighting one off the one I got in my mouth.
Are you still reading like the physical copy of the
New York
Times?
Yeah, I do read the physical paper in the morning, which I do really. The great thing about that is it just directs your attention to things that are not going viral online.
Yes.
Which is a really key thing.
Yeah.
Because you know, the physical paper is a attention directing technology in which people make editorial decisions about where they think your attention should go and is not subject to the whims of shares, virality, algorithms. And that is really, really useful. You also just read better when you're reading, you know, reading on paper. I think it's weird. People have a lot of animus against the New York Times right now, and I sort of understand it, and some of it I think is pretty profoundly misplaced. But I do think a physical subscription to the newspaper is a great idea.
Yeah.
It really is. And I got a thing about papers piling up, and it makes me feel neurotic and claustrophobic.
Same, yeah.
But
it is good. The editorial attention direction, I think, is something that we're missing.
I have read more articles about the war. The New York Times has been covering the war in Ukraine with tremendous amount of resources and sustained focus. And those stories never take off online.
Yeah.
No one shares them, talks about them. And I've been reading their coverage, and it's really good coverage. I feel like I have actually a way better understanding.
But I remember thinking about this when the war first started. I was like, Putin, he just wants to wait everyone out because he knows that in the age of attention, it's going to go away.
It's like a log in a fire, man. It burns up fast, and then you got to come up with ways to throw more logs on there.
Yeah. It's a fantastic book. Seriously, everyone read it. I've been recommending it to everyone.
That's awesome.
If you listen to the show, then you absolutely should read it.
yes, like you are like right in the audience.
All the offline characters are in there, so you should definitely read it. Chris, thanks for coming by.
It was great, man. Thanks.
Offline is a Crooked Media production. It's written and hosted by me, Jon Favreau, along with Max Fisher. The show is produced by Austin Fisher and Emma Illich-Frank. Jordan Cantor is our sound editor. Audio support from Charlotte Landis and Kyle Seglin. Delon Villanueva produces our videos each week. Jordan Katz and Kenny Siegel take care of our music. Thanks to Ari Schwartz, Madeline Herringer, and Adrian Hill for production support. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America, East.
Hi, I'm Alex Wagner. I do not need to tell you that being an American right now is a wild ride. But as a longtime journalist, I am not interested in the noise or the fear-mongering. I'm interested in the stories at the heart of the headlines. That is why every week on my show, Runaway Country, I'm joined by folks in the middle of the crossfire. From disillusioned MAHA moms to newly fired immigration judges to Epstein victims themselves, to understand what it means to live through this political chaos as an actual human being. And now I'm excited to tell you that Runaway Country is available ad-free to Friends of the Pod subscribers. Friends of the Pod is the subscription that supports the work Crooked does as an independent media company and gives you a ton of great bonus and ad-free content. With the midterms approaching, you are going to need more content to keep you sane. And now you can find Runaway Country right there. Subscribe now at crooked.com/friends.